Well, thank you very much, David. And firstly, I must say it's a great pleasure and indeed a great honour to have been invited to speak here this evening with such a distinguished panel and such an incredibly important topic for the higher education sector. When Theresa May announced her review of post-18 funding back in February 2018, I think universities saw it as an opportunity to ensure that post-18 routes, both in higher education and in further education, are properly supported, that they are accessible to everybody over 18 who would benefit from a higher level of education, whatever their background, and whatever their background was very important. So I would like to extend my congratulations to Philip Auger and the members of his panel for delivering such a comprehensive report, spanning some 216 pages and 53 recommendations. And it's quite clear that they have considered a vast amount of evidence in their deliberations, and I've no doubt we're going to have some very interesting debate and discussions in the forthcoming months. I think there was a concern that the review would look at different parts of the post-18 system in isolation and could be somewhat fragmented. But I think that's not the case, and we really welcome the very joined-up approach that you've taken in examining the very different components of our tertiary education system. There are several key tests that the review's recommendations must meet if we're going to maintain quality, access, and choice, and ensure that our post-18 system can meet current and future skills needs, and also support the projected growing number of people who will want to access higher education in the coming years. These tests cover some critical themes. Will the recommendations improve access to higher education? Will they plug the nation's skills gap and help to drive that much-needed increase in productivity? Will they improve the quality of higher-level education? And will they increase the positive impact that universities and college have in their local communities and more broadly, both nationally and globally? Will current and future students be supported in making informed choices about higher-level study? And will the recommendations support student mobility across all four nations of the UK by enabling students to study wherever they want to, whether it's in Southampton, Sunderland, Swansea, or Stirling? Now, of course, it's far too easy to judge whether the review meets each of these six tests. Much will depend on how the government and the new Prime Minister respond, and I know this is not a subject for debate at the moment, but he or she will need to decide the extent to which they want to progress the recommendations of a review that is so inextricably linked with their predecessor, and how the proposals fit with their vision and offer to modern Britain. So I'm going to focus my comments on higher education and leave discussion of the important issues raised about FE to Stella. But I think the report offers many opportunities for FE and HE to work together more closely, which I, for one, very much welcome. Now, insofar as higher education is concerned, I think the recommendations are a little bit, if I may say, a mixed bag. There are some clear positives, including positions argued for by Universities UK and others, but there are some areas of concern. So firstly, the proposed cut in tuition fees, or as I would prefer we called them, university fees, from £9,250 a year to £7,500. Now, this may appeal to students on the surface. Analysis by UUK estimates that it would result in a £1.8 billion reduction in funding to universities unless this funding was made up in full by the government. Universities like my own would need to make some very difficult decisions. These decisions would impact on students, their education and their broader experience, on access, participation and social mobility, on staff, on local communities, on employers, on research, and on our collective ability as a sector to maintain the UK's position as a global leader in higher education. So we welcome and very strongly support the review's recommendation that the income lost to universities by a cut in tuition fees should be made up in full by the government. But in the current political and fiscal climate, this is a very, very big ask, and it's a very significant risk. Now, in recommending that the average unit of resource, i.e. the investment needed to fund each student, is protected, the panel has effectively recognised that this is, as a minimum, the cost of educating a student. The burning question now is, will the government recognise this too and commit to the full replacement funding in the forthcoming spending review? Will and can the Treasury give a cast-iron guarantee that the funding shortfall will be covered in the long term, not just the short term, and will include grant funding to support the expected growth in student numbers, which will start in 2021 as the 18-year-old population begins to increase? Now, if this funding can't be guaranteed, then it's very difficult to see how tuition fees can be cut without causing serious damage to our students' interests and to the sector more broadly. I and my colleagues at UUK am fearful that the richness of the student experience would suffer, as universities would, for example, be forced to increase class sizes, pare back on learning resources, reduce investment in staff, in new teaching methods, in infrastructure, and in the support and advice services they offer to students, such as those for mental health. As a scientist, I'm particularly concerned that the teaching of practical subjects would suffer if funding is cut. Engineering, natural sciences, medical and health sciences, design and technology are by their very nature practical subjects, as too are the creative arts and also modern languages. If universities can't afford to invest in the equipment, the consumables, the staff, and the infrastructure needed to deliver this teaching, then the quality of our provision will be damaged and we will not produce the high-quality, practically orientated graduates that industry is seeking to enable that drive in productivity. The report rightly acknowledges that the UK higher education sector has an outstanding reputation for research. However, it says very little about the critical interface between research and education, which is key to the success of the sector and central to research-led teaching, something that I would regard as a hallmark of a UK university education. Exposing students to research and introducing them to researcher skills is a core part of what we do in universities. It takes students to the cutting edge of their field, it opens their minds, it sharpens their thinking. It helps them to develop and apply critical and analytical skills, to interrogate and challenge the evidence base, to develop logical evidence-based arguments, and to solve problems, etc. These are the intellectual skills that so many employers are looking for in graduates, and they are delivered through countless courses, not just the STEM subjects, but also in the arts, humanities, and social sciences. And of course, a research-led education is also key to developing the pipeline of future researchers, which are needed to deliver the government's aim of increasing investment in R&D to 2.4% by 2027. The damage cuts will bring to our academic offering would also impact on the global reputation of UK higher education, at a time when we have to recognise that global competition is increasing enormously. We welcome the commitment in the government's new international education strategy to grow international student numbers by 600,000 by 2030. If we're going to succeed in doing this in the face of growing international competition, we must protect the quality of our offering. A further risk of the proposed funding changes is that increased direct government support will come with more strings attached. Now, some may say this is legitimate. Indeed, some even may say it's a good idea. But more centrally controlled higher education systems tend to perform less well. They're less agile, they're less innovative, and they're less responsive to changing economic needs. A critical test for these proposals will be the extent to which funding could be directed and whether that would undermine the autonomy of our higher education sector. Now, the sector was particularly concerned that the post-18 system should be progressive and support social mobility. The current system's not perfect, but as acknowledged in the report and by Philip just now, it is progressive and access and participation have improved. In 2017, 18-year-olds from the most disadvantaged areas of England were 82% more likely to enter higher education than in 2006. In addition, universities have invested substantially to support these students in their transition into university and taken significant steps to improve retention and successful progression to rewarding graduate-level positions. We've still got a long way to go, but I think we're very definitely on the road. Now, students repeatedly tell us that living costs, the pound in their pocket during their studies, are a very significant worry, particularly those who come from disadvantaged homes or from care, who need to borrow more money than their better-off peers to fund their time through university. Hardly a level playing field. Very often, these students combine full-time study with long hours in paid jobs simply to make ends meet. This puts them under huge pressure, with little opportunity to relax or engage with the broader experiences that university offer. The sector has long been calling for the reintroduction of means test maintenance grants to support these disadvantaged students, and we very much welcome the report's recommendations, and we hope the government will take them forward. We also welcome the proposal of a reduction in interest rates on loan while students are studying. However, we are concerned that the other recommendations on loan repayment may be regressive, including extending the loan write-off from 30 years to 40 years. And much has been made of this in the media in recent days by the money-saving expert Martin Lewis and by others. Cutting fees doesn't necessarily mean that all graduates will have more money in their pockets or end up paying less for their courses in the long term. The government's own analysis shows that high earners will be the winners and that someone on average earnings, such as a nurse or a teacher, will pay back some £12,000 more over their lifetime than under the current system. Now, the report steers clear of restricting student numbers or recommending a minimum entry requirement for higher education, at least in the short term. Both would have damaged the opportunity for those with potential to benefit from higher education, but who have a lower attainment, many of whom come from disadvantaged backgrounds. However, there is a worrying suggestion that measures to limit student numbers may be imposed in the medium term. The report challenges the sector to deal with courses that have poor retention, poor graduate employability, and long-term earning outcomes. Now, while I would be the last person to try and defend poor quality courses, this set of issues raised is not simple. We appreciate the proposal that the sector should have time to explore the issues that have been raised and work out how best we can address the challenges presented. Some of this time, I think, should be spent reframing the narrative on the real value of higher education and what it brings to society, and considering whether we've got the balance right between the prevailing focus on graduate salaries, which can sometimes be misleading if you look simply at the LEO data, and the broader social and cultural value of having an educated population. The increased focus on encouraging more flexible learning is very welcome to ensure that a more diverse range of learners can benefit from higher and further education. The proposed introduction of a lifelong learning allowance will go some way to address the calls that Universities UK and the CBI have jointly made to improve the opportunities for flexible learning. With a rapidly changing workforce, this could enable more people to learn as they earn and access education in a way that suits individual circumstances at all stages in their career. But we mustn't underestimate the obvious challenges this will bring that need to be worked through, not least in developing a credit system that supports the modular approach described in the report, and study at all levels, including PhD, and of course a system which is accepted by the professional bodies that accredit many of our degree programmes. We must also understand more fully the implications of the four-year timeframe proposed for the lifelong learning analysis. How will it impact on social mobility and the disadvantaged, and what will it mean for master's and doctoral study? We're particularly concerned about the proposal to remove loan support for foundation years, which provide a very valuable pathway into higher education. At my own and many other institutions, we run a number of these programmes and believe they are a true aid to social mobility. They enable students who've not had a good experience at school to make up for lost ground and also at the same time to adapt to university culture before having to join the main degree stream. Of course, they don't work for everyone, but a very high proportion of these students go on to do extremely well. The final test the review must meet is that it must avoid restricting the ability of UK students to select the right course at the right university, which is right for them, wherever that might be in the UK. The UK's higher education system has enabled students from all four nations to study in any part of the UK, regardless of where they're domiciled at the point of application. The review, although England-focused, risks disrupting cross-border flows and having unintended consequences for student choice across all four nations. So we will want to see the UK government take time to consider the responsibilities to students and universities across the whole of the UK, not just those based in England. Over the coming weeks, we should also recognise that the report comes at a time when the sector is facing a number of other significant issues: Brexit, changes to immigration policy, and of course a very challenging pensions environment. Universities must be at the heart of efforts to boost productivity and growth, to bring prosperity to all regions of the UK, to drive innovation, and to deliver high-quality research that changes lives. Any consideration of the impact of the review must acknowledge and respond to these broader challenges. The review's report is still hot off the press. There's an awful lot to be done to understand the full impact of its recommendations, how they interconnect, how much they would cost, and whether they will produce the results intended by the panel. A period of consultation with a broad range of stakeholders must now happen. So I hope that the tests I've outlined today will help to guide assessment of whether these recommendations will enable our post-18 education system to sustain and enhance its positive impact on individuals, the economy, and the whole of British society. And incidentally, we'll put the next Prime Minister in the position to say, as confidently as Theresa May has done, that UK universities are world leaders and a jewel in Britain's crown. Thank you.